This is Culturetopia, with the week's very best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Ann Hawk, an editor at Morning Edition.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage, from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between.
And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
a new documentary about a little-known collaboration between Walt Disney and the government.
A baseball player with an unlikely love of poetry. And Jay-Z returns with his latest album, The Blueprint 3. But first,
we start with a really cute boy. Matthew Morrison looks like a heartthrob, but he's an old-fashioned triple threat. An actor, singer, and dancer. He starred as Link in the Broadway production of Hairspray and won a Tony Award for his role in The Light in the Piazza. But now Morrison's on television. He plays the high school teacher turned Glee Club coach, Will Schuster, in the musical comedy series Glee on Fox. NPR's Lynn Neary asked Morrison if he was wary about taking on such a part in a big TV show.
You know, if I could have written a part for myself, this would have been it. It's a perfect transition to, from going from stage into TV.
What makes it so perfect for you?
Well, you know, obviously the singing and dancing make it really special and suited to what I do well.
I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
And, you know, I've kind of based this character on a couple of teachers that I've had in the past.
Who? Tell me about those teachers.
Well, one of them is this guy, Ralph Opasek, who was the director of the performing arts program that I went to in high school. The other, his name was, I call him Mr. Dorn, obviously, but his name is Phil Dorn. He was an English teacher I had in high school. And he was just so optimistic. One of those teachers that it was just, everything he said, it was just so infectious.
Let's talk a little bit about the high school in Glee, because it's very funny, and it really does work with the stereotypes we all have in our minds about high school. I mean, did it bring back any bad memories for you of high school? Or
no, I actually had such an amazing high school experience. I know, you know, there's no real middle ground when you talk about, when you ask people about their high school experiences. They either loved it or they hated it. I'm probably the only person in the show, the only actor on our show that really just enjoyed high school. I got the most out of it. I was involved in so many programs. But the character on our show that I kind of associate myself with is Finn, because I was really into athletics as well, and I kind of had to choose at one point between playing soccer, which was my sport, and being in the musicals.
And of course, Finn is the jock, the quarterback on the football team, who decides to get involved with this kind of pathetic group of very talented singers and dancers in the Glee Club.
And I can't fight this feeling anymore.
I suddenly realized why I had wanted to do this thing in the first place.
What I started fighting for.
It was seeing the gift in a kid that they didn't even know they had.
And I can't fight this feeling anymore.
It was pure talent.
If I have to crawl upon your floor, come crashing through your door, baby, I can't fight this feeling anymore.
Now, your nemesis in this show is the head of the cheerleaders, who is played really brilliantly by Jane Lynch. We're going to play a clip of a scene in which she gives you the lowdown on the high school pecking order. Let's listen to that.
Okay, so what you're doing right now is called blurring the lines. High school is a caste system. Kids fall into certain slots. Your jocks and your popular kids up in the penthouse. The invisibles and the kids playing live action, druids and trolls out in the forest, bottom floor.
And where do the Glee kids lie?
Sub-basement.
You know, Netta, when I was in high school, the groups were called the Pigs and the Jocks. And I love Morrison's revival of John Denver's Leaving on a Jet Plane. That takes me back. It was part of my repertoire as a child when my sister and I used to sing and dance around the living room. And speaking of sisters, remember best-selling author Deborah Tannen?
Mm-hmm.
Her new book, You Were Always Mom's Favorite, looks at the passionate relationships between sisters, the closeness, and the competition. Susan Stamberg spoke with Tannen.
You were always Mom's favorite.
Do all siblings feel this way?
I think yes. Whenever I talked to women about their sisters, they would tell me who was the favorite. Now, they didn't always agree.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, our perceptions aren't always right. But, yeah, we think in those terms.
Yeah. And you say that nobody really shares your life the way sister to sister can, that you're closer in age than you are with your parents. That's an extremely important relationship, too, of course, but nothing like the sister relationship. And you're moving through history pretty much at the same time, and you're the same gender, so that's different in most cases from your relationship to your husband.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, the siblings and especially sisters are more influential in your childhood than your parents because you're together more. Sometimes it's a very positive effect. Your older sister was always protective of you. But you also hear from people whose entire lives they feel inadequate because of something the sister teased them about. Her ear stuck out. She looked funny when she smiled. She uses words wrong. A woman in her 70s told me it. If anyone corrects her use of a word, she really reacts to that because her sister always told her that she used words wrong, and it made her feel stupid.
Well, you write that it is a relationship about competition and also definition. And those are very interrelated. One is the pretty one, one's the smart one, one's the athletic one, one's
the bookworm,
and on and on.
That comparison, it can be frustrating because you feel you're pigeonholed. You know, I can't draw. I couldn't even think of drawing because my sister was the one who was supposed to have that talent. And sometimes it gives you a starting point from which to decide who you're going to be. So one woman's sister, they were adults. She said, did you ever wonder why I played the bagpipes? And she said, well, why did you? Because you didn't. A chance to define yourself in comparison, but also sometimes in opposition.
Well, you keep talking about sisterness, but you're also talking so much about birth order, and that's central to it too, isn't it? Because the oldest is always mother-like in some way.
Right. I can't tell you how many times I heard from younger sisters that their older sisters were bossy and judgmental. So you ask why? Think of the older one who always knows better, has a right and maybe is assigned the task of telling the younger ones what to do, and maybe it becomes a habit.
But that bossiness and the judgmentalness, in a way, I hope this doesn't sound too Pollyanna-ish because I'm an only child, is the flip side of caring, isn't
it? Yes, it's the double meaning of the word bond. Hmm. There's the bond of a connection and there's the bond of bondage. You have a close bond. That's the positive thing. It's the connection. But when you're connected to somebody, everything each one does affects the other. And it's a kind of bondage. You're not as free as you would be if that person wasn't in your life.
Well, let's just say I'm very bonded then with my sister. And you can hear the rest of the interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
In 1941, the U.S. government was concerned about diplomatic inroads that Nazi Germany was making in Latin America. So the State Department looked to Hollywood for a counteroffensive. Specifically, they looked to Walt Disney. This little-known initiative is now the subject of a new documentary called Walt and El Grupo. Here's our critic, Bob Mondello.
You'd think the Disney studio would have been riding high in 1941. Snow White and Pinocchio had been huge hits. Dumbo and Bambi were in pre-production. But world affairs were cramping Walt Disney's style, especially a war in Europe that was drying up foreign markets and capital.
The whole world was collapsing then. And so I just practically stopped my feature production. That's all I could do. Then is when I had the strike.
An animator's strike at the house the mouse built left the filmmaker seriously depressed, so when the Roosevelt administration came calling, urging him to make a goodwill tour of Latin America, he was eager to get away. Not eager to just shake a lot of hands, though, so he got the government to send his top animators with him and made it a working tour. The idea was to research future films by soaking up the sights and sounds of Latin America, and soak they did. Filmmaker Ted Thomas is the son of Disney animator Frank Thomas, who made the trip, so he had access to a motherload of documentary material, letters the animators wrote home, sketchbooks they filled, and photos of them filling them, staring at, say, a live parrot as they created their cigar-smoking animated parrot, Joe Carioca.
Donald, I will show you the land of the samba.
Samba? What samba?
December.
The rhythms captured on this trip were as much a revelation to the Disney group, El Grupo, as they called themselves, as the colorful foliage and animals were. This was an era when international travel was not yet common, and in 16mm home movies from the trip, you can see the excitement as 1940s cities burst into gaudy state welcomes for the creator of El Ratón Mickey. The State Department evidently got it right. More than a decade before Walt Disney became a familiar face on TV, the huge crowds suggest that this goodwill tour actually generated goodwill. And the documentary doesn't settle for showing that. It mixes in new footage, so the image can fade from a sketch of Donald Duck sitting on a balcony with a mountain in the background to a shot that is clearly that same balcony today with Rio's Sugarloaf Mountain in the background. The filmmakers even found some of the folks who performed for Disney, including an ancient, almost toothless dancer who narrates footage of his 20-year-old self stomping and twirling with Disney all those years ago. He and Disney couldn't understand each other, he says, but Disney seemed happy. In his later life, Walt Disney would get a rep as a control freak with a dark side, but on this trip he was not yet 40, still willing to wear a gaucho costume and twirl a lasso, just as Goofy would in a cartoon that emerged from the trip. The Oscar-nominated movies Saludos Amigos and Three Caballeros were the immediate result, filled with stereotypes, yes, but comparatively friendly ones. The State Department was pushing a good neighbor policy, remember? And in return for a guarantee, in case the films didn't earn their money back at the box office, which they did, by the way, Walt and El Grupo were happy to promote the idea that it's a small world, after all. I'm Bob Mandello.
And in another unlikely pairing, the September issue of Poetry magazine has an unexpected contributor. It's someone you're more likely to know for his speed in running the bases than his rhyme or meter. Fernando Perez, a 26-year-old outfielder for the Tampa Bay Rays, has written an essay about his love of poetry. NPR's Melissa Block spoke with Perez and asked him if he keeps a book or two of poetry in his locker.
I do. I have this John Ashbery book, Chinese Whispers, that I'm starting to get through. And, there's the infamous meeting with Mark McGuire when he's sitting in his locker, and I guess the reporters saw whatever it was in his locker. And similarly, I was in my locker in spring training, and, somebody saw, I think it was My Life, the Hegelian sort of crossover book. And not quite the same thing. But, it's funny. That's how it all began. People started to kind of ask me, you're a ball player. What are you doing with that sort of thing? But, often I do have it.
Do you think that that poetry in some way gives you perspective on baseball, or is it really more of a release from baseball? Are they just occupying two completely different spheres in your life?
They are totally different. Poetry to me is, I don't necessarily want to say that it's a release. It's just something that has become a part of me. I'm lucky that baseball has continued to be a part of me because I've been involved in it so long. To me, it's my preferred means of communication, my preferred food. It's just kind of what I enjoy consuming the most.
And you write in this essay, you're in love with baseball, but she's slowly going to break your heart. Poetry will not break your heart, at least not that way.
It can't, because especially being the type of player that I am, I'm, a speed guy, high-flying. Baseball is a thing. You have your prime, and I'm sort of entering it. And then when you come out of it, it's just you aren't able to do the things that you were able to do. I just sort of really what I meant by that is just poetry is sort of a long thing. I think I'm just starting to understand what's coming out of me. I'm just slowly starting to understand what I'm producing. Where it fits.
I'm thinking, Fernando Perez, baseball players have an at-bat song comes out through the PA system when they come up to bat.
Yeah.
You know where I'm going with this, I think. I think it's time for you to have some free verse out there, a little John Ashbery or something. Mix it up.
Maybe so. You know, I was quoted as saying, I can't do that, though, because when you play this game, you really see it's a circus for the fans, really. You know, so I would just probably come out to something that they would rather hear, like, you know, James Brown or whatever is cool at the moment. You know, I don't think I want to put people through that because it just doesn't seem like that's what they would want.
Now to a high-flying poet of a different sort. Jay-Z is out of retirement, again, with a new album called The Blueprint 3. It's his 11th solo album in 13 years. Our reviewer, Oliver Wang, says Jay-Z, long one of hip-hop's indisputed kings, has managed somehow to stay untoppable.
In a minute-long TV ad made to promote The Blueprint 3, Jay-Z glides through a photo shoot, restaging every iconic pose from his previous 10 album covers. We are, yeah, I said it, we are. This is Rock Nation. Pledge your allegiance. Get your fatigues on. All black everything. Black cards, all black everything. The commercial is all about reminding people where Jay-Z's been. There's even a song called Reminder on The Blueprint 3. However, elsewhere, Jay flips things around, urging listeners to stop dwelling on his past. Don't be mad, cause it's all about progression. Loiterers should be arrested. I used to drink Cristal, them f***ing racist. So I switched gold bottles on to that space. You gon' have another drink or you just gon' babysit. On to the next one, somebody call a waitress. If Jay-Z can't decide if he wants to focus on the past or the future, he's clear on where he stands in the present. The Blueprint 3 is well-versed in contemporary pop trends, though not always in a friendly manner. The album's first single, DOA, Death of Auto-Tune, critiques the ubiquity of the voice-altering software in today's pop music. Begin. This is anti-auto-tune, death of the ringtone. This ain't for iTunes, this ain't for sing-alongs. This is Sinatra at the opera, bring a blonde. Despite his disdain for auto-tune, Jay isn't anti-pop. Indeed, now that he's signed multi-million dollar deals with music promoters such as Live Nation, he's more of a global entertainer than ever, and he knows it. The Blueprint 3 is easily one of his most commercially savvy albums to date, aiming for relevance in Walmart kiosks, Hollywood clubs, and Brooklyn bodegas alike. It helps that the songs are generally brighter, less violent, and less drug-themed than past efforts. Jay also invites current 15-minute famers such as Drake and Kid Cudi. But nowhere is the album's populist ambitions as clear than in its dance-friendly, electronic-infused rhythms. All kinds of minimalist beeps, burps, and claps bump alongside huffing synthesizer vamps and blaring banks of horns. The Blueprint 3 is Jay-Z's strongest release in recent years, though overall it would only rank somewhere in the middle of his catalog. It lacks the singular cohesion of the original Blueprint album, and Jay-Z's once unrivaled flow sounds more pedestrian at times. There's also the matter of basing a song around Alphaville's 1984 hit, Forever Young, a move that says anything but forever or young.
Hey, may the best of your todays be the worst of your tomorrows. But we ain't even thinking that far. You know what I mean? So we living life like a video. Where the sun is always out and you never get old. And the champagne's always cold and the music's always good. And the pretty girls just happen to stop by in the hood.
To be fair, this is his 11th release. And at this point, Jay-Z has attained the rap equivalent of Bruce Springsteen or U2 status. Each new album aspires to be an event, though it becomes harder to reinvent yourself when you're this deep into a career. That's why The Blueprint 3's broad appeal is a powerful statement in its own right. Jay-Z has outlived, literally and figuratively, so many of his peers, yet in what could have easily been the twilight of his recording days, he's still standing, still striving, still shining.
Thank you very much for coming out. evening.
And that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Neda Ulibi.
And I'm Ann Hawk.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. Black tux, binocular, black lux. Stop it, I shouldn't be so popular. Main key.